So we begin with a new subject matter tonight called faith, and it's still on our general series of the fundamentals of Dharma. And it's a little hard to talk about, obviously. It's going to require an extra willingness to sort of stretch into the listening of this talk to sort of see if you can renew your acquaintance with faith. Many of us have been scarred by that name or have a very strong reaction to it. And so especially if we've come out of a faith-based religion in which faith was the reason for doing what everyone did, but there wasn't much sanity or wisdom within that doing. So we really do have to redefine this word. But first let me show you why the word is such an important word in all fields, all spiritual fields, certainly this one. Because what we're doing, in essence, in the Dharma, is we're uprooting the center of our gravity, you might say, the center of life. We're uprooting the way we have perceived, the way where we think we are in relationship to all other things. And whenever you tamper with sort of the keystone of any particular building arrangement, the entire building gets very shaky if it can withstand that tweaking at all. And so we need something. If we are learning to sort of mistrust our sanity in some ways because we're misperceiving life in its essence, and we're also questioning our need to control all things, everything, right? Our knee-jerk response is to move towards the assertion of control in most situations, in almost all situations in which we feel threatened or insecure. So if we're taking that away, or at least questioning it, where's the fall? What do we fall on? What's left? Where, if you pull out the stakes, you know, what happens to the tent? And so we need something to come in here so that we have a safe landing, you might say. And that's faith. Faith comes in. Now, what do I mean by faith? I define it as the willingness to enter the unknown without guarantee. So it's living without the need to control, basically. There's a quote that I like from a Mary Jean Iron. It said, faith is not being sure, but betting your last cents. Okay, so faith is not being sure, but betting with your last cent. That's sort of what we're doing here. It's like we're never going to be absolutely sure. How could you be sure of something that is unknown? You wouldn't, if you were sure of it, you would know it. And so the fact that you're not sure of it assures that it is unknown. And yet, for some reason, we move into it anyway. And our desire to control, to pull back into safety, is the resistance we feel in life. Is when you sit, the kind of guardedness you feel, you know, the contraction, the immediate consolidation of our strength and our power, that resistance that comes back into forms ourselves from it. Well, that's because in that moment, we don't have sufficient faith to relax. Now, I just had a crown from a dentist. And I says, okay, I'm going to practice faith. I'm giving a talk on it, right? So I'm sitting in the dental chair. It was into my bottom, but she just kept pumping this Novocaine in. So I couldn't even feel most of my throat. And then, you know, the drilling started where she carves out most of the tooth and just leaves kind of like a pillar where she can put a cap on. I think that's what's happening. Four hands in my mouth. And I'm going, I don't have a lot of faith in this, you know. I don't know what those hands are doing. I don't know, you know, the competency of the... I mean, there was this need to keep pulling back in the kind of an insecure format through worry, through doubt, through fear. And I could just see the formation of what I was trusting. What was I going to do? I mean, it's not like I could get in there with another hand and help it out. You know, so all of that was completely wasted energy. You either had to trust them or get out of the room, right? And I wasn't about to do the latter, and yet I couldn't stop the almost instinctual need to kind of contract around what was happening. So it's a very interesting situation. You know, when you're, I'm sure when you're in the throes of an illness where you're being treated by some chemotherapy or some drug that you have that's a poison, basically, and you're supposed to relax with it and let it work, you know, and you go, and I could see how that there would be this almost instinctual need to be guarded against it and to protect oneself from it. But it happens all the time. We have really very little faith. We do, no, I'll say that differently. We have 100% faith. It's just in us, not in reality. We believe we can master, overcome, detour, or deflect almost anything if we're given sufficient power or technique. And yet the spiritual journey is really calling forth something else from us. It's asking something from us besides our own need to sort of stay in abeyance or distance ourselves from whatever experience might be threatening. And so this need to resist, this need to hold back, is really the counter urgency to faith itself. And we, as Dharma students, are asked to learn how to relax with life, to learn how to relax, and to really let it in. And when we let it in, it isn't going to be what we thought it was. We're never going to let in reality when we know what it is, because we always perceive it as being separate, individuated, and therefore potentially threatening. Anything that's separate from you is potential threat to you. And until and unless we can get a sense of the connectedness of things, we're never going to be able to relax within the matrix of life, within the many, many displays of life. So spiritual journey is really all about whose control we are allowing. Right? What do we lead off with? Now, I like to access faith through questions, because the questions, and I'll just give you a few questions that can orient you to a perception of faith, or at least an investigation of faith. Like, what is in control in this moment? That's one in which you have to, when you start controlling the fear tendencies within you, when you start questioning those fear tendencies, what is it that's going to catch my fall if I don't pull back in safety? And the second one, is there anything beyond my own empowerment? Now, I mean, nobody would be in this room if they felt like all of life was totally, that they were the center and essence of all the power in life. You may feel like it sometimes, but it certainly isn't the correct perception of life. The third question, is there anything greater than me? Because if there isn't, let's go and have fun, because this is a waste of time. might as well enjoy the pleasures of life as long as they last, if it's only about me. And then a question of what holds reverence? What uplifts the spirit? What, you feel that buoyancy every once in a while when you touch awe or beauty. What is that? What's happening in that moment? See, those are really questions of faith. In Pali, the word sadha, which means placing your heart upon. Now, whenever you place your heart upon something totally, there is a releasing of the tensions, the mental tensions associated with that activity. So faith requires a kind of devotion. There are many words that cover the description or definition of faith. So bear with me as I just define it with a few words. But one of them is devotion, and for some people it takes the expression of a deep sense of gratitude. It's hard to exactly know what that gratitude is focused upon, but there is this expression, perhaps, of knowing that there is something else besides one's own empowerment that I'm gracious for. And that allows an orientation. I mean, in this tradition, you know, we don't call it God. We call it a reality. We adjust ourselves, our lives, so that we don't resist reality. And so reality holds a kind of impersonal quality to it. And yet their heart can well up, even within that context of those words, with a deep appreciation and gratitude for something else, for the safety net of what life ultimately holds. So it does hold the word gratitude, but it also holds the word trust. And may I say that trust is an issue for many people because of their early childhood training. They learn not to trust, and they pull back into a kind of mistrusting relationship to life. Most of us, perhaps in this room, grew up in that kind of environment. And it's very hard to come out again. Because when you're young and mistrusting, and then as the ages begin to move on, we accumulate a certain capacity to reason from our sense of manipulation and power. And we also begin to utilize that manipulation of power to get what we want. When we didn't have the power, we were betrayed, perhaps, or at least we were scarred. And now that we do, we're going to fight back in the empowered ways that we know to do. But that's really emphasizing the disconnected aspect of our perception, right? Where others are there for our manipulation. And to come back into trust is really to come back within connection, not disconnection, and to see whether it's trusting now that I'm adult. Yes, we had our problems while we were a child, but let's try again. We can't just live our young, early childhood training throughout our life. We're an adult now. We can say no. We can say that's enough. We can say whatever we want to say. But we have to, emotionally, we have to re-educate ourselves to that capacity. That can be difficult to do. So there's an activity of faith. We can all hear that trust is necessary, that faith is the ultimate act of trusting, but there's an activity, which is why I give the homework I give, because the activity is what actually allows the trust to resume itself. You can't expect, yes, I know I need to be trusting, and never move outside your mistrust. You have to actually put it into action, your trust into action. If that means your relationships only get to a certain point of intimacy before you break them off and make some excuse about why this person isn't right for you, then it's staying the unpleasant or sometimes the very annoying situations that have led to our breaking that relationship and just moving into a deeper level of intimacy. If for nothing else, is to exercise that power or that capacity within us. Doesn't mean necessarily the relationship is going to, you're going to force yourself into a long-term relationship just to, but to exercise it from time to time. To offer a greater percentage of ourself to the world so that we meet it. We meet it so that we place our heart upon. So trust, confidence. Now, confidence is a very important word in faith. Confidence, all of us have a certain degree of spiritual confidence. With insight, with wisdom, comes an assurance that this is true. And we stand on this. We don't lose it. You stand on it. You realize that your capacity to see and to reveal and to access the truth of that of those revelations builds a body of confidence within us. We know where we stand. We're not apologetic for where we stand. We say what we want to say. We're not looking, as long as we're ethical, we're not looking to mistreat anyone, but neither are we willing to have ourselves be mistreated. And so there's that stability of form that is part of the growth of the Dharma, and that's part of the willingness to undertake this adventure. If you're going to step into the unknown, you've got to have confidence in yourself to be able to do that. If we're flaky or shaky, believe me, we're not stepping anywhere outside of our own empowerment. There's kind of an adventurous spirit that faith has as well. Is with that confidence, with that devotion, with that trust, there's a kind of way that we're willing to dare a little bit, or risk. And that sense of risk and adventure feed each other very nicely in this game. In fact, if you think about it, the subject that we talked about previous to this was wisdom. Wisdom comes after faith. Faith precedes wisdom. Unless we're willing to see something, right? Unless we're willing to venture somewhere into a new perception, allow a new perception to unfold, become unguarded in a moment, drop our shields, wisdom is impossible. So the willingness to drop our protection, see what's there, is wisdom. The seeing is the wisdom. The dropping of the guard is faith. We don't have wisdom before we drop our guard. We just sense that if we keep holding our guard, we'll never see anything. So in a flash or an immediate moment here, we will drop our resistance. We'll see. But then what happens is that the wisdom, the seeing, adds confidence to the faith. So now I dropped my guard, it was safe. I saw what was on the other side of my thought. It came back and became fully embodied within me, and now I'm willing to risk again. And so the willingness to see something new is dependent upon the risk of becoming unguarded. So faith and wisdom work hand in hand. You see that? That's very, very important to see. But the amazing thing is that they feed each other. And that's why I'm giving this talk in conjunction with wisdom, because the two are really dependent upon one another. Now, some of us have rather shaky confidence levels, and if we do, then our faith, you can be sure, is going to stumble. If we're unethical, or if we're doing some kind of violation of the principles on which we are moving the Dharma forward, our confidence isn't going to be there. We're going to be slightly paranoid. We're going to have thoughts of what we've done. And so when the confidence is weak, then our faith is going to be weak. So that's one of the many reasons that ethical conduct and just living in accordance to the principles that you seek to uphold are so important in driving this thing forward, because the very way we move forward is dependent upon those principles. May I say also that despair is the opposite of faith. Now, faith in the beginning, let me talk a little bit about what it looks like in the beginning, because all of you began at some point this Dharma practice. What got you from there to here? What allowed us to have the courage, which is part of the attribute, another attribute of faith, the courage to continue? Well, there's something called bright faith. Bright faith in the literature talks about just the sense that we're onto something. Do you ever feel that when you hear a Dharma talk? Perhaps when you were in the beginning class, God, this is onto something here. You know, it's not just a lecture on physics, where they're onto something, but it's a lecture that invites our heart forward so that we're along with the very discussions that we hear. We join the fact that we're onto something. And there's something beautiful about that, because the faith has not been actually converted to wisdom, but there is the willingness now to take on an adventure. And that willingness to take on an adventure really establishes a central part or place within our spiritual journey. Now, may I say, you can just make the practice entirely based upon your will, where, okay, now I'm onto something, but I've got to, you know, just kind of hard, white-knuckling, bearing down, forceful, volitional, intentional, and screen out all the faith in the doing of that. And the reason I bring this up is because when I came back to the States after being away 4 years in Asia and 4 more years tucked in a retreat center in Massachusetts, after 8 years of not being involved or engaged in the culture in any way, I came back from Asia and I was just terrified. It was the worst 6 months of my life as I reoriented myself back to the culture. And it was because I had no faith. I'd been practicing for a number of years, but I had done it all for my own control, for my own assertion of power. And I was going to do this, and I knew exactly where I was going, and I was sort of, and it just dawned on me, the amount of fear that came up that arose from that was so considerable, I couldn't just dismiss it based upon just the circumstances. I realized that the practice was failing me because I had failed the practice. My faith was totally in my drive, in my will, in my own strength. And I relearned a completely different orientation to practice soon after that, because I realized that, in essence, although you get strong muscles, they are just not in the right place in your body to go forward in the spiritual journey. So I say that just so that we begin to understand that it doesn't look certain. Faith doesn't look certain. It doesn't look like a well-mapped out territory here. It looks gray. You're just willing to try. You still think you're on to something, hopefully. You haven't lost that in all the years you've been practicing. But you have this sense in yourself, we all have it, that the deeper we relax into what's left, deeper into life, the more something else arises and shows itself. And we start having faith in that process. We start understanding that our exertion of will keeps me in place, but keeps the sense of otherness, the sense of connectedness, the sense of what's greater than me out. Of course, if you're acting from your will, you're going to only know your strength, and your perceptions of the world are going to be around you. When we start releasing that and allowing something else to be seen, we have to become less important. And it takes faith to make that journey. So, but let your practice be intended in that direction. Because if it's not, you're going to find that there will be times when your faith will be tested. And if you haven't done that, like when you're dying, and if you haven't had that privilege of practicing relaxation in relationship to the next step of life, then your dying could be ugly. And I would hate to see that for you. So this sense of bright faith is not a belief. Now, we're going to have to be very careful here, because there is blind faith. But we're not talking about blind faith. Blind faith adheres to a doctrine, right? It's groupthink. Blind faith is filled with doubt, because a belief is only as good as how intensely you believe. But it's not based on anything. It's just based on a belief. So you gather around people who also believe. And if all of them in the room can believe and nod their head, then you're okay. But if there's somebody in the middle of that group that's going this way, then you've got to do something. You've got to get him out of the group or her, or you've got to convert them, proselytize. And so then our force, because you have to, if they're not shaking their head in the same direction you are, what it does is access the sense of disbelief in me, because belief has no absolute confidence. It's only as strong as my belief. And belief is not wisdom, so it's not very strong at all. So you begin to see how shaky blind faith is. But you also, at the same time, it's very opinionated, for instance. There's full of doubt. It's an often aggressive doubt, you know, as we try to assert the importance of our opinion. But you can also see in relationship to that how freeing bright faith is, because bright faith isn't trying to proselytize at all. It's not trying to convert anybody. When you sense it in yourself, you don't have to argue it. It's not a point of contention. At first, when we first begin, the bright faith is accompanied by just a sense of exhilaration and wanting to talk to people about it. But as they yawn, you learn quickly that they're not as interested in it as you are. But it's still an important aspect of learning, that we're not trying to convince them so much as to share a kind of spirit, a sense of joy that we're feeling. So that bright faith is also a part of taking refuge. You know, when you want something to land on in form, and that's where the Buddha stands. You know, the Buddha stands as a symbol of what we could have faith in. If he can do it, so can I. He was a human being. I'm a human being. He was actualizing his potential and thereby showing me mine. And in that sense, you know, we can sense that this is to be uncovered rather than to be argued. And that's a very important difference between bright faith and blind faith. But, you know, we'll fall into the trap sometimes early on because our faith has not yet been verified. Now, after a while in practice, it becomes verified. Verified means that we see the Dharma for ourselves. There's nothing like that. We talked about wisdom. We talked about insight. We've talked about how that transformation occurs. And, you know, it's like trying to argue that, I don't know, trying to argue anything. If you have an oak tree in your yard, and somebody says, no, that's not an oak tree, that's a maple, and you say, no, it's an oak tree, I know it. And you're not going to argue about whether, it's just like, he can believe what he wants to. It's an oak tree, that's it. It's like, I know, you know something, you know it. You don't have, there's no reason. It doesn't require anything. It doesn't require reactivity. In fact, when somebody tries to argue the Dharma with you, what often comes up is compassion for how they're so guarded that they won't let this in when it's so accessible and can carry them, everyone, anyone, as far as it can. But to get to verified faith, where we actually are seeing for ourselves, can take some time, especially if you're new to practice and your mind is very discursive and you aren't seeing, you're just trying to hold yourself to the pillow and on, it can take some time before the mind learns over time to settle down, to be stationary enough so that it begins to see. Once it begins to see, then it gets hungry for more seeing. And when faith gets verified, it adds to the confidence. There's a confidence that comes with that. And a sense of a waning sense of doubt. There may be doubt about things you haven't experienced or you don't know dharmically, like selflessness or whatever. But there's no doubt about what you do know. I don't know how many people in here would argue permanence. If somebody met you on the outside and started saying, "No, I think everything is permanent," you would, it's like, okay, time to move on. There are just certain aspects of life you just don't need to dispute. So the other thing about the middle ground of faith, and this is really important, is that along comes that confidence, comes a sense of willingness to try again. You know, okay. You know, all of us fall off the mat. All of us go long periods of time without sitting or something because events get in our way. We feel that we've lost our direction. You know, children come in and consume our lives, whatever it might be. And here you are. You sit down and there you are. It's like riding a bike. You haven't lost a thing. It's like I lost 100,000 miles on the bike. That doesn't mean anything. You're sitting on the seat. You just use it for what its point is to move forward. You know, don't worry about the miles you haven't traveled when you're on the bike. And there you are. It's just that sense of here I'm back again. And so it's always a refreshing. It's always there for us. It's never some compounded problem over time. And why did I find the Dharma when I was so old? You found the Dharma with the optimum time that you found the Dharma for you. If it's the moment before you die, so be it. Or if it's 50 years before you die, that's nice too. But this is not quantifiable, right? It's just, okay, you know, all of this, these distractions happen, we don't even know what's going on, we're reacting, the argument's over, I'm back. Hello, how are you? I'm fine, now. So I'm back. And it's just a clean slate, this ability to begin again, to renew ourselves, to begin again. And that comes, it's like windshield wipers, you know? Even if you didn't have your windshield wipers on and the windshield was covered with water, it just takes one swipe and there we can see clear. So this willingness to, you know, not to encrust our life in regret of what we haven't done and where we lost ourselves, when we're sitting in the middle of everything in a spiritual moment of clarity, don't bring in regret to that. Let it move forward in faith. Don't have to mind it into the ground. Just, that's it. It's clean. Let's go. You ready? Let's go. That's all. And that doesn't matter how long you practice to come to that point. Now, there's a quote here by a Mary Ford that I want to read because I think it really gets to the point. She says, "People who go through the process of discovering their own truth and learning to trust and develop certain people who go through the process of discovering their own truth and learning develop certain qualities. The first one is perseverance. That's what I was just talking about. I don't have time to regret. I don't have time to begrudge what I didn't do when here I am in the middle of that very doing. Just, that's it, the windshield wiper, that's it. So that's an important one. The second one that she mentions is an impatience with hype. Now, I don't know if that's happened to you, but it will. Where you get so clean in your own, and what you're willing to see and entertain in yourself, without all the embellishing stories and the narrative, the continuing narrative, you just get very clean in what your own inward dialogue is about. That you can see very clearly when somebody is basing their life on exaggeration, and so you don't have a lot of. Well, it's not that you get impatient, it's just that you can see right through it. That's all. And you just waiting for them to come back so that you can have a talk with, that you can actually have a conversation, you know, so for some reason we think, especially in this time of life, I mean, in this epoch, we think everything has to be entertaining. We think that we have to entertain in order to really converse. You know, just turning on the news in the evening disgusts me so much because it's just entertainment. You know, I grew up in the Walter Cronkite era, where that's the way it is. He would end, you know, that's the way it was. And as it was, it was just raw news coming out, and you just... And all, like, everything has to have a certain kind of intensity and excitement, a certain exaggerated importance, and the lead stories will often, you know, be something about how a lost dog walks 100 miles to find his way back home when Syria is in decimation, and that gets to be the story at 5 minutes to the close of the hour. It's like it doesn't make any sense anymore. So we have to make sense out of it. And you start finding this, okay, so let's just line this thing up in ourselves, and then everything also gets lined for you. It doesn't mean that you can't have fun and frolic and be childlike. You can. I'm talking about something different than that. I hope everyone understands. The third part, she says, the capacity for self-reflection. Well, that's what we're learning here. So I'm assuming that every one of us in the room has that capacity. And fourth, she says, and this is a nice point, an openness. Not the openness that flaps with every wind, but an open-mindedness that seems natural when you trust yourself enough to listen to others and not lose your sense of direction. I don't know about you, but for so many years in my life, you know, I had such poor confidence in anything I said that when somebody was with an opposing point of view or suggesting I go right instead of the direction I was taking, which is left, I would be in a state of complete confusion and pandemonium. I think, oh my God, I had no center of self in which to make that decision, no confidence. But as the practice comes into our cells of our body, that confidence lands. And then you listen to what someone might be suggesting, but you don't outweigh your own opinion. It doesn't outweigh it necessarily unless it makes more sense. But it just, the sense of, what did you say, flapping in the wind or whatever it is, you lose your sense of direction. You just don't. How many directions is now? I mean, no matter what somebody tells you you need to do, you always have now. How can we lose that direction? I mean, nothing is more important. No matter what direction you take, it's not important than the acknowledgement of now. So if you just acknowledge now, everything else is secondary. That's it, really. So it never needs to take us away from that primary central location. And then I want to mention faith in the end. Talked about faith in the beginning, bright faith, and then faith in the middle, the verified faith. Now, the faith in the end, which I call abiding faith. And the point of all this, the spiritual journey is a journey of surrender. That'll be my next talk. Surrender requires the loosening hold we have upon our own desires and fears and acting those out in relationship to the broader sense of connectedness, interconnectedness, and basic goodness that comes from that. And as we concede the point of our own will to this sense of faith, there becomes a living faith. It's a verb. We live it. It's not something that we do. It's not something that we practice. It's something that becomes the very access, the very dimension of our being. Said differently, the mind surrenders to the heart. And it involves that trusting, ability to trust, and the ability to stay connected. But most importantly, it involves three words that I gave you at the beginning of the sitting, and I just want to reinforce to you. It involves relaxation and just the willingness to feel the ease of well-being. Because if we're not relaxed, that tension assures the fact that we are talking ourselves out of faith and into ourselves. We're pushing the wrong power button here. And then there's the observation, the willingness just to observe and to believe in the discernment of observation, of awareness. That we don't have to do something. We don't have to guard our observation to make sure we act appropriately. That the action is contained within the observation. That the action will come out of the observation. We don't have to go in with a plan and then observe. We can go in just observing, and the plan will come out of that observation. It will be an intrinsic part of that observation. The discernment really is a beautiful attribute of awareness that covers over all of our professed needs to make life around our own sense of influence. And then the word allow, allowance. Now that really captures the essence, I think, of faith. When we talk, just allow. In each of these words, just as I mentioned them, work your body and mind into that orientation. Now I say relax. Observe. You can feel how each of them work on the other. Each of them feed the next. Now allow. See the openness, availability that might not have been there in the observation, but you can't avoid it in the word allowance. That is the activity of faith. Relax, observe, and allow. That's all. That's the activity. Okay, can we take just a moment or two? Okay, as we sit here, relax. What only thing that will keep you from relaxing is if you think there's some reason that you need to stay guarded. But what reason could possibly be here that you would need to guard against? observe. From your pores, not from your eyes. Observation is not sense data. Everything observes. Everything has that capacity. And allow. The cell of the human body has some billion activities to keep foreign objects out every second. It performs all these intricate ways to screen out threats. It's taken care of you. You don't have to take care any further than that. You don't need a billion and one. Now just let the mind relax. Let the mind express itself within that relaxation so that we're not trying to move it in any direction. We're just observing it. And whatever arises, we just allow it to happen. That's the essence of the meditation. That's the essence of the activity of faith. Okay, good. Thank you. So if anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to bring forth, I'd be happy to respond as best I can. Yes. Very interesting and very important question. She's talking about a crisis of faith, that when incidences and circumstances can be disastrous, and then during or after that there can be a sense of needing something to hold on just for stability. And depending upon what that loss encumbered or what the details were, it may feel like your mind is being pushed to its edge. Meditation in itself won't necessarily stop the mind from feeling the trauma of what just occurred. And sometimes we can sense that trauma as being just too much for us in that moment. And in that case, you do what's appropriate to get through that particular time. You seek help. You do whatever is needed in terms of therapy or friends or support. So after a while, with some distance between that time and yourself, you can see that you're never going to be able, and the practice is not meant to govern circumstances. It's not meant to smooth out life so that you have no rough edges. The point is that when those rough edges occur, we show up for them sufficiently so that we can learn about, really, faith. Not only after the event, but also through the event. And I'll show you what that looks like. After the event, some period of time, like, I won't say a number of months or years, but at some point you can turn back around and look at that event and see how you actually grew from it, how it benefited you, when you didn't have any context for being able to see that while it was happening. And then you have a sense of faith that incidences or circumstances aren't just happening, you know, just chaotically, that there is some way that all the circumstances are meant to move us forward if we use them in a correct way. And so there's a faith in the way the universe works, as well as a faith in our ability to move through those circumstances and work it in that way. So those are very important understandings. Wisdom, again, which feeds back into the faith, that even in a crisis, I was thinking about this day because I was hearing a talk on somebody who was giving it in 2009 about 2012, and he was saying that it's the tipping point. 2012 is going to be the tipping point. He's a scientist, and he's reciting all the different things that are happening now, and he says it could be a tipping point in which it throws civilization out of context so that we don't have, it could just be complete disorder. So I was thinking, okay, so if that happens this year or next year or the year after or within my lifetime, I'll be okay. Even if physically I'm not okay, even if, you know, circumstances are chaotic, I really sense that, you know, it's because it's not about circumstances. In fact, the Dharma is about the formless that can hold any form, not about having a certain, you know, construction of form in order to get through this. It's being independent of form. How will we know the formless unless we are independent of form? And form is just circumstances, just experiences. It's the death of this or that. It's this person getting old and that person, you know, it's all of that. It's the wind blowing and the fire raging. It's also the peaceful times in the park. Come to our Sims picnic. So it's all of that. It's all of that. You see? You see where the confidence is? Now that's living faith. Because if you are otherwise, we have our faith is in circumstantially. That things will be all right with me. Please, dear God, in the prayer and whatever, you see? Please save me from. Please make my life better. Please do something. It has nothing to do with that. It's not going to be good. You may be homeless. It's just not going to be, it's not going to look the way you think it is. This isn't a plea to God, you know. This isn't some salvation. Physicals. This isn't a form salvation. You can't save form. It's going to die. It's going to get old. It's going to deteriorate. What holds form? Paper wraps rock. What holds form? That's where this thing is going. And faith is the expression of being able to hold all aspects of form. See? Thank you for that question. That's very true. She says one area that she feels a growing sense of faith is with accompanying those who are dying. Because there it is. There's the form, and then this form's dying, and then there's the infinite. You can feel it if you're in the room with somebody who's dying. I have lots of stories that I could tell on that point. You can also feel the infinite. The person dies, form is dead, but then something else. It's undeniable. And so this sense of what is beyond is immediate, and what is limited is also known. You can see the whole of the Dharma on that bedside. Right? And if you have the capacity to accompany it, you also have the capacity not to fear it. I encourage people to expose yourself to that if you haven't, because you'll see very quickly what you have to learn to make your life and death smooth. Yes. Well, all futures unknown. I mean, there's no future that isn't unknown, right? It's just whether we think we have the intermediate steps to get us there, right? But there'll be a time when you don't. In fact, you don't have it any time. But let's just say that there will be a time when you have an illness and you won't know what the future is like with that illness. Okay, so where is the, when I came back to the States, I had become almost Asian in my cultural orientation. I'd lost any excitement about this culture whatsoever. And it was like, and so it was just a complete unknown. And I was walking and I had to function. I had to get a job. I had to work. I had no money. My parents had both died. I had nothing. I had no place to land. No money, no job, nothing. So what do? You see? And I was like, whoa, homeless? What do? Well, here I am. I'll save you the muddled details, but look, here they are. Think of whatever has happened to you, all of it, all the steps. Now look, here you are. This is it. Oh, you don't understand how awful it was. Here we are. This is it. Something got you through here, to here. Something. And I dare say it wasn't your cleverness. So we can relax in this thing. We don't have to make it so, such an anxious life. It doesn't have, it's like, okay, you really, but you can't do that if you will yourself or you don't really start looking or investigating what your sense of control is and what you can't control. Just look at what you can't control. We think we can control the future, but can you? I mean, that's all there, if you had any control at all, would be in the future. And you have very little, very tentative, very tentative. Now here we are. Okay, all good. Thank you.